This is Stephen Richard Taylor versus the Attorney General for the State of Florida Department of Corrections. Sean Gunn is here for Appellant Taylor. Jason William Rodriguez is here for the Department of Corrections. And Mr. Gunn, you may begin.
Thank you, and may it please the court. Sean Gunn, Assistant Federal Public Defender, on behalf of Appellant Stephen Taylor. There are five issues in the COA, and I'm happy to address the court's questions on any of them. But if I may, I'd like to begin with the Fry issue, which is that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to challenge the admissibility of the state's DNA evidence under Fry. This is fundamentally a case about flawed DNA evidence from the earliest months of DNA testing by the state of Florida. The state's DNA expert, James Pollock, opened the Florida Department of Law Enforcement's first forensic DNA laboratory in the spring of 1990, less than 18 months before testifying at Mr. Taylor's trial that DNA found on the victim matched Mr. Taylor and that the odds of it being another person's DNA were only 1 in 6 million or perhaps even 1 in 23 million. This highly damaging evidence from the Stone Age of forensic DNA testing in Florida was flawed. The jury heard it anyway because Mr. Taylor's trial counsel failed to invoke the established procedure in Florida for challenging novel scientific evidence, a Fry hearing. This was deficient performance under Strickland. If trial counsel had filed a Fry motion, the state would have had to prove that its DNA evidence was based on generally accepted techniques. Counsel didn't move for a Fry hearing, not because he made a decision, but because he didn't know Fry was the established mechanism in Florida for challenging novel scientific techniques.
Can I ask you just a quick question? Is it possible, given sort of what we think we know from the record anyway, that we know from the lawyers questioning at trial, for instance, that he had a fairly firm grasp on sort of DNA evidence and technology more generally? Should we not infer that he was reasonably well enough informed to think that this was generally accepted and that a Fry motion simply wasn't appropriate?
Sure, I don't think so, Judge Newsom, because in post-conviction, trial counsel himself testified he didn't know about Fry. He didn't know Fry was the standard, and he testified he didn't do any research on it.
Well, that's not really what he said, is it? What he really said was that he could not recall his level of awareness of Fry at the time. So, I mean, there's a difference between that and he didn't know about Fry.
Well, I think the looking at his testimony in context, to me the takeaway is that he has no specific memory of knowing about Fry and he has no specific memory of researching it. He couldn't say for sure that I absolutely did not know about Fry, but I think there's preponderance of the evidence in the record on that deficient performance prong of Strickland. And the state, by the way, has never challenged the idea that he didn't know about Fry or that he didn't research Fry. And the circuit court nor the Florida Supreme Court challenged that either. So this appeal comes to this court with that idea that trial counsel didn't know about Fry undisputed. So I take Your Honor's point that trial counsel was not definitive about Fry, but I think all we have in the record indicates that he did not know and did not research Fry.
Go ahead. So does this fall into the bucket of failure to conduct a reasonable investigation rather than a strategic decision?
Correct. And this stems from Strickland. The U.S. Supreme Court just emphasized this principle recently in Hinton versus Alabama. And this court cited Hinton and cited Strickland and two preceding cases, Williams v. Taylor and Kimmelman v. Morris, for this proposition that counsel cannot make a strategic decision if counsel doesn't know the law, doesn't understand the law, and doesn't research the law.
You mentioned Kimmelman. Can I just ask you a question about that? So Kimmelman, if I'm remembering correctly, that's the case that says, with respect to prejudice, we need to sort of pierce through and ask whether or not we think this motion would have worked, right? Whether it would have succeeded.
Correct.
And is there really, do you think, given the way that the trial court handled the voir dire of Pollock and allowed him to testify anyway, do you think that there's good reason to think that the trial court would have gone the other way on a Fry motion?
I think there's good reason for the simple fact that the Florida Supreme Court has repeatedly made clear that a Fry motion triggers an adversarial test. So there would have been an expert on the other side testifying in addition to Dr. Pollack. There would have been a full airing of these issues. And so I don't think we can necessarily look at how the trial court ruled on Dr. Pollack himself and see how, and infer how it might have ruled on the Frye motion. The second point is that the Florida Supreme Court has made clear that you also have to look at what would have happened on appeal, or this court has made that point in the Butcher case. And if you look at the Florida Supreme Court decisions around the time that Mr. Taylor's direct appeal would have gone up there, the Florida Supreme Court was reversing cases on Frye grounds, even based on evidence that was not available to the trial court. So in the case Hayes, the Florida Supreme Court reversed on a Frye error based on the National Research Council report that came out after the defendant's trial, and this was another 1990 homicide. If I could circle quickly back and just make a couple more points about deficient performance. Strikingly, Taylor had a co-defendant, Gerald Murray, whose conviction and death sentence were twice overturned by the Florida Supreme Court based on counsel's preservation of a Frye motion. And as I'll discuss a little more regarding prejudice, DNA testing in this case was equally as problematic as in Murray and Hayes and the District Court of Appeal case Vargas, in which Dr. Pollack testified, and these were all reversed under Frye. And it's worth noting that this court recently has found Mr. Taylor's same trial counsel ineffective for this very reason, for failing to understand the law and failing to research it. And that was in the case of John Hardwick. And in that case, Mr. Tassone, this court explained that Mr. Tassone did not understand mitigation law and did not do enough research into it and reversed under the Hinton line of cases.
So the district court didn't reach the prejudice prong. Right?
Correct.
And so is my understanding correct that in order for there to be prejudice, if we determine that trial counsel was ineffective, you would have to convince us not only that the trial judge would have granted his motion for a Frye hearing, but that motion would have been successful?
I think that's correct. A reasonable probability.
Okay, all right. That's a pretty heavy burden that you have, taking into consideration that we have to give AEDPA deference to the Florida Supreme Court's decision.
Well, actually, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
The Florida Supreme Court also did not reach prejudice on this claim, so this court is reviewing that de novo. And I think on de novo review, there was prejudice because there was a reasonable probability the Frye motion would have been granted, or if it was denied, that it would have been reversed on appeal.
All right. Now, I suspect, and it's you begin with, I think, is your strongest issue on appeal. I suspect that when the state gets up here, they're going to tell us that there was sufficient evidence to convict him in the absence of Pollack's testimony. And so what do you have to say about that?
Well, I'd say a couple things about that. First, I think you have to look at the other evidence that was presented in the context of the DNA evidence. Mm-hmm. When a jury is told that there is only a 1 in 6 million or 1 in 23 million chance this was another perpetrator, that places a gloss on all the other evidence and may make it seem more convincing to the jury. But going to the other evidence itself, besides the DNA evidence, there is no real physical evidence tying Mr. Taylor to this crime or implicating him in specific acts as opposed to his co-defendant.
What about his jail cellmate? I can't remember his name at the time. Was it Timothy Cowart?
Cowart,
is that his name?
Yes.
And so his testimony was pretty damaging, wasn't it?
I think that is really the only piece of evidence that does implicate Mr. Taylor, but mm-hmm. we have to look at Mr. Cowart was a jailhouse informant who allegedly heard this statement from Mr. Taylor in the presence of many other inmates in a crowded jail mm-hmm. who apparently never heard this. He was cross-examined extensively about his criminal history. And so I don't give a lot of weight to the idea that without the DNA evidence, the jury would have taken Mr. Cowart.
Okay. And I couldn't find the answer to this. I don't know if it's in the record or not. What kind of deal did he get as a result of his testimony on behalf of the state?
I believe he received a 60-day sentence. He was in for petty theft. I think he was released immediately, having served that sentence already.
Okay.
And just while we're on this topic, what about the testimony with respect to the bag of jewelry?
Sure. The,
the bag of jewelry that is found in his former residence. I think all that shows is that Mr.
And
Taylor...
And the digging for it by the fence and all of it, right?
Sure. This was a house that Mr. Taylor used to live in, did not live in anymore, that Mr. Murray and his little brother also frequented. Mr. Murray's little brother was actually with Mr. Taylor on this incident when he was digging in the backyard. And he did come out and come back with his hands dirty. Even if we assume that this evidence links Mr. Taylor specifically to this crime, all it shows is that at some point he knew where that jewelry was. And this is months after the crime. So we don't know if he learned that from Mr. Murray. We don't know. It doesn't tell us anything about what happened at the crime scene. So I don't think the jewelry witnesses are particularly compelling.
Then you also had the evidence from the serontologist about the blood typing. Would you address that in terms of prejudice?
Sure. Well, Diane Hansen testified that the blood typing matched Mr. Taylor, but she also testified that a third of the population has that same blood type.
But wasn't it less than that because only some of those people are type A secretors?
I think that's true. I can't remember the percentage that brought it down to off the top of my head. I want to say it's 25%, but I believe it was still a significant...
I thought it was 33.
It may have been 33, but in any case, I don't think that the blood typing would have been as convincing to the jury, certainly as the DNA evidence.
But there's not nothing, right? I mean, there's Cowart and there's Hansen and there's the jewelry. So it's I take your point, and I think it's a powerful point that the DNA was sort of the 800-pound gorilla in the case. But there's not nothing left over, even if you take the DNA out.
That's true, and. In many cases, you know, there's always going to be inculpatory evidence. You know, a case that springs to mind is the Kyles case, the Brady case from the Supreme Court, where they reversed the conviction under Brady, even though the defendant's fingerprint was found on a receipt with the victim. And we can also look to Mr. Murray, because Mr. Murray twice received reversals under Frye, even though the evidence against Mr. Murray was actually stronger than against Mr. Taylor. Mr. Murray had a pubic hair that microscopically matched. There were no hairs that matched Mr. Taylor. And Mr. Murray also had a jailhouse informant, and his jailhouse informant not only implicated him in the burglary and the murder, but also in the sexual assault. And so even looking at all that evidence against Mr. Murray, the Florida Supreme Court found sufficient prejudice to overturn his conviction and death sentence twice. If I could just make a couple more points on prejudice, Your Honors. Mr. Pollack himself admitted in the state post-conviction proceeding that what they were doing in Florida was, quote, not generally accepted, even though the FBI protocol was generally accepted. So even from Dr. Pollack's own testimony, we know that what he considered the Florida Department of Law Enforcement's procedure, the protocol with his handwritten modifications, he even characterized that as not generally accepted in Florida, which makes sense because DNA testing in the forensic setting had only been around for 2 or 3 years. I think the first conviction with DNA in the United States was 1988, 1987. So we're talking about brand new technology, which is tailor-made for a Frye motion, and that really highlights the ineffectiveness and counsel's failure to seek to exclude it. And I do want to just, as to prejudice, as to whether the Frye motion would have been granted by the trial court and upheld on appeal. The post-conviction record shows that Dr. Pollack's evidence fell below general acceptance in a number of ways. There's the protocol deviations, some of which are implicated in the Brady claim. They involve the use of only 4 probes, the interpretation of faint bands, using the female fraction to create a match to Mr. Taylor, using over 10,000 base pairs to declare a match, even though the FBI had said that is unreliable and bands that large should not be interpreted. So those are the protocol deviations. There's also the inadequate reliance on the databases for the population frequency and use of the product rule. And I do want to draw attention to the case I mentioned earlier out of the District Court of Appeal in Vargas, because there you see Dr. Pollack provide shockingly similar testimony to the testimony in Mr. Taylor's case. And what the District Court of Appeal said in that case is that Dr. Pollack's use of the product rule to create the population frequencies was not generally accepted under Frye.
Can I ask you a quick question? Is there some tension between the Brady and Trickling claims here? Because it seems like either he did know about the deviations and failed to bring them up and so was ineffective, or he didn't know because of a Brady violation?
I think this is one of those cases. I wouldn't say there's tension, but I think it does teeter on the edge of one of the two, and you could see it either way. The Brady claim, the COA was only granted on specific protocol deviations, but when the court examines the Frye issue on the matter of prejudice de novo, it can look to not just the specific deviations that were granted a COA on Brady, but all of these other issues, including most prominently this issue of declaring a match on three probes using only the female fraction, which Dr. Libby testified in post-conviction is really not appropriate. Dr. Ziegler, who did the second read of Mr. Pollack's analysis, looked at the computer printout, saw no bands detected in the male fraction, and said, these probes I would call inconclusive. So, you know, there's been a lot made by the Florida Supreme Court unreasonably, I believe, on this issue.
Can I ask you, and sure. I may now be carrying you into territory you don't want to talk about, but you mentioned both Libby and Ziegler. So Ziegler really didn't take exception with the ultimate findings, as I understand her testimony. Now, Libby did, right? But Libby was found incredible, I guess is the word, not credible, by the state court. And how do you overcome that credibility determination?
Sure. As to Ziegler, I don't think that's quite right. I think the Florida Supreme Court, you're correct, the Florida Supreme Court said there was no prejudice because Ms. Ziegler ultimately agreed with Dr. Pollack's findings. I don't think that's correct. And I think if you look back at the briefing, that suggestion comes from the state. But when you look closer, what we're really talking about is the computer printouts. My understanding of the way this works is that when the auto rads are placed into the computer, there is some human interaction in creating the computer probe sizes, which is why there are slight variations between Dr. Pollack and Dr. Ziegler. And so the state and the Florida Supreme Court took that and said, these are very similar computer readouts, and therefore they didn't ultimately agree. But what they're missing is Ms. Ziegler's testimony that looking at her printouts, she would have said that the D1S and D4 probes were inconclusive. And it is true that she was not asked about this issue of matching in the female fraction, but I think we can infer that because she was looking at her printout and saying the probe was inconclusive. Almost, it was in the back of her mind that you wouldn't take probes from the female fraction and use those to make a match.
Am I remembering incorrectly, though, that she testified when asked, I think point blank, would your analysis have been helpful to the defendant? She said no. She said it was redundant and that she didn't have any sort of fundamental dispute with the bottom line conclusion.
I don't remember that specific part of the testimony, but remember, Ziegler was not at the trial, did not see Dr. Pollack's testimony, and so she was responding to a computer printout, Dr. Pollack's and hers, and ultimately saying these aren't much of a match, but she didn't see Dr. Pollack testify to a match in those two probes. As to Dr. Libby, I don't think this, and this is another issue that I think has been carried from the state's briefing and made it into the Florida Supreme Court opinion, and that is that the circuit court in post-conviction found Dr. Libby not credible. I don't think there actually was an adverse credibility finding against Dr. Pollack. If you look at the circuit court's decision, what they actually say is that they're going to give Dr. Libby's testimony less weight because he doesn't have sufficient experience in forensics. And so this is not one of those instances where the trial court is able to observe the witness's demeanor and make a credibility assessment that an appellate court should defer to. The court was looking basically at Dr. Libby's resume, and this traces back again, I think, to the state's closing argument, where they urged the circuit court not to give his testimony significant weight and actually derided Dr. Libby as a West Coast expert. And this made it into the circuit court as a weight of the evidence finding, and somehow from there into the Florida Supreme Court, it got translated into an adverse credibility finding.
But even if it's just weight of the evidence, I mean, aren't you still in sort of D2, E1 land where you've got to show clear and convincing evidence that that weight of the evidence determination was wrong?
Sure, and I think the clear and convincing evidence comes from Dr. Pollack, Dr. Libby's testimony, because remember, we don't just have...
I guess what I mean, though, I don't mean to cut you off, but I guess what I mean is the extent that the Florida Circuit Court said her, even if she's not non-credible, her credibility is diminished in some respect in my eyes because she doesn't have, I keep saying she because the name is Libby, I'm so sorry, doesn't have sufficient experience, isn't that a factual finding that you've got to show clear and convincingly, that was clear and convincingly erroneous?
Yes, and I think to show clear and convincing that that was erroneous, we have not only Dr. Libby's CV in the record, which does indicate that he had training in forensics, and by the way, Dr. Libby also explained that forensic borrow these techniques from the medical field, and so it's not as if not having expertise in forensics is a significant hindrance. But the more important point is that if you look at Ziegler's testimony, she corroborates essentially what Dr. Libby is saying about those probes not matching. She doesn't testify specifically about the female fraction, but Dr. Libby was very specific that you should not be matching probes based on the female fraction. And Ms. Ziegler also said that two probes didn't match. So I think you have corroboration there. And Dr. Libby was also essentially testifying based on the modified protocol he had in front of him. So I think we have the modifications to the protocol, we have Ziegler's testimony, we have Libby's CV, which shows he does have forensic experience. And so I think you take all that together and you can make a D2 finding premised on an E1 finding on that basis.
Well, the state says that they gave Taylor's lawyer the copy of the protocol, which included Pollack's handwritten modifications and other reports which would have shown him the deviations, all right? So, I mean, that cuts against your Brady argument, doesn't it?
Sure. Well, I think that's speculation. I think the state is open about this. We don't know that the protocol was turned over. The state believes that it's strongly suggested based on a list of items that Dr. Pollack had sent to the defense expert, describing a 35-page manual of procedure. We don't know if that was the protocol, and we don't know if that was the protocol with the handwritten modifications. And even the protocol with the handwritten modifications did not contain all the deviations that were present in this case, including the issue with the female fraction. And so there is a COA on the Brady issue as to the match in the two probes, the D1S and the D4, and those two were both premised on bands found in the female fraction. If I could, I'd just like to move quickly to Miranda, that issue, and make just a couple of quick points here, because I think the Florida Supreme Court really botched this analysis. There's three issues here under the clearly established law of Edwards and Bradshaw: whether Taylor invoked his right to counsel, whether he then reinitiated and waived his invocation, and whether he was then interrogated before making this statement. As to invocation, I think the record clearly shows that the officer involved, Bogers, was aware that Mr. Taylor had invoked. Mr. Taylor was actually being questioned at a homicide office by two other detectives when the search warrant came in. One of those detectives and Officer Bogers then walked Mr. Taylor to the place where the warrant was executed. And Bogers testified at trial that he was told that Mr. Taylor had invoked his rights.
It seems to me the state's strongest argument with regard to the Miranda issue is that Taylor initiated this conversation on the way back to his house. He was the one that initiated the conversation and not Detective Boger.
Correct, and that's what the Florida Supreme Court hung their decision on too, but I think that's a clearly unreasonable application of federal law because the standard is not whether Mr. Taylor initiated, it's whether that initiation constituted a waiver of his previous invocation of the right to silence. The key under Bradshaw is whether Mr. Taylor's initiating statement revealed a desire for generalized discussion about the case or whether it was an inquiry related to the routine incidents of the custodial relationship. So Mr. Taylor asking when the DNA would be coming back, if you look at some of the other cases applying these standards, this was more of a routine inquiry, and Officer Bogers inappropriately then took that question, which he could have answered by saying a week or two, or I don't know, and instead he says, why do you want to know? Which I think was clearly an intent to jostle something from Mr. Taylor for the investigation.
Because it seems, remember, though, that you're kind of trying to have it both ways, because the AEDPA standard, for good or ill, is sort of stacked against you. And you're saying, with respect to your client's statement, it was a nothing, it was casual sort of conversation, routine stuff. But the return, now we should really squint hard at that and say that that was really designed to elicit information. It just sort of seems like you're imposing different standards of colloquial speech or something on the given actors in this discussion.
Well, the reason I say that, Judge Newsom, is because the Supreme Court in Innis, the standard for interrogation, doesn't even require words. It's any words or actions that the officer reasonably should know is likely to elicit an incriminating response. And so I think Y meets that standard.
So Taylor was in custody at the time that he made the statement? When he was back, he was still in custody?
Mr. Taylor was, as I said, questioned at homicide. He's walked over to the nurse's station, which is in an old jail. He's brought up the back stairs. He's behind three locked doors. The samples are taken, and then he's told he's free to go. But he is still in that environment, and he could not find a way to get out of there. He tried calling several people for a ride home, and so the officers ended up walking him back to homicide and stayed with him again there for several, I don't know if it was minutes or hours, until they eventually took him home. So he never left the presence of these homicide detectives.
So where was he when he made the statement?
He was walking between the nurse's station at the jail and the homicide office.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Rodriguez.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, Jason Rodriguez, Assistant Attorney General on behalf of the Secretary of the Florida Department of Corrections. Today I'll explain why the district court was correct to deny Section 2254 relief for Stephen Richard Taylor, a Florida death sentence capital inmate who is presently challenging a roughly 32-year-old judgment and sentence. Like my colleague, I'll spend most of the time on Issue 3, the Fry analysis. And there are some things that I think are important to emphasize first, and the first of those is what counsel actually did in this case. This isn't a situation where counsel engaged and saw, well, this is a DNA case and I'm going to do no investigation or research. He got a DNA expert appointed to him. He spoke with that DNA expert, and that DNA expert told him there's nothing wrong with the state's testing from his point of view. A reasonable counsel could stop moving any farther after that. He's got his expert telling him, ultimately, there's no issues with the state's testing. The state obviously has confidence in its own testing. There is no Sixth Amendment requirement to go and get a second opinion from somebody else. So I think in a very quick way that ends the Fry analysis, because the ineffective assistance of counsel for failing to raise Fry in any event, because he did an investigation, he got an expert, he spoke with the expert, and ultimately that didn't yield any fruit. The second thing that I really want to emphasize is how unclear Florida law was at this time. And I stand by what I said in my brief. Unfortunately, Florida had a tortured on-again, off-again relationship with Fry that really has still gone into where now we use Daubert. In Florida, if counsel had investigated the DNA issue, the critical issue in this case, the case he would have stumbled across would have been Andrews versus State out of the 5th District, the only case in Florida that analyzed DNA, Fry, and Daubert prior.
The question I have about this, though, is that, I mean, it seems, you seem to be saying that, you know, Fry's been out there for a long time, right? Even at the time of this trial. It was hardly new precedent. And you seem to be saying, well, he needed precedent applying Fry to DNA. But I thought the whole point of Fry was to bring to bear this standard to newly emerging technologies. So why would you need like a DNA Fry case?
Your Honor, because unfortunately, and I think that Andrews talks about this a great deal and some of the other cases, it wasn't clear to even Florida's judges whether Fry had actually been adopted in Florida. If you look at Andrews itself, it does not use Fry. In footnote 6, it says Fry is the wrong test. We're going to use Daubert. So I utilize Andrews, even though there are Florida Supreme Court cases that analyze Fry, to show the great degree of confusion over whether we were utilizing Fry or Daubert at all. And Florida's judges were coming to the conclusion that we're actually using Daubert, at least as it pertains to DNA. If that's the conclusion Florida's judges were reaching, then certainly counsel could not be in effect for failing to raise a Fry motion that hadn't been established as meritorious at that point in time. The law was at best unsettled, and so because it was at best unsettled, he could not be ineffective.
Let's go back to the co-defendant, Gerald Murray.
Yes,
sir. Did he also have an expert that he told him, don't worry about the DNA evidence?
Your Honor, I don't know, to be entirely honest with you. I'm not sure, but I think with Murray, what's...
Did, doesn't that cut against your argument that there wasn't deficient performance because he made a strategic decision based on consultation with his expert?
Not at all, Your Honor. And I think it's important to recognize the Sixth Amendment doesn't, you know, request or doesn't demand what an ideal attorney would have done on an ideal day. Maybe the ideal attorney on an ideal day gets a second opinion. That doesn't mean that an attorney is deficient for failing to rely on what his singular expert has told him. But as it pertains to Gerald Murray, I do think a couple of other facts are important. Murray went to trial in 1994, 3 years after Taylor went to trial. And where the law was becoming much more clear, maybe not quite at the level of clarity we got in Hayes in 1995, but people were raising these Fry objections, and they were becoming much more common in the intervening years after Taylor's case.
Fry's a pretty old case. I mean, it's a 1923 case.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, I mean, it wasn't, I mean, just a recent phenomenon at the time. And but, there were Florida cases on the books concerning a attorney's obligation to request a Fry hearing when there's an issue about DNA evidence.
Your Honor, the only case that I'm aware of regarding DNA and Fry prior to 1991 is Andrews.
What about, okay, all right.
I think there were lots of utilizing Fry in other ways for other post-hypnotic testimony was Stokes in 1989.
But before this case, Florida courts had begun to recognize the admissibility of DNA evidence as a new and proper scientific procedure, though, right?
Yes. In 1988, Andrews, I think, is the critical one out of the Fifth District, where they used not Fry, but Daubert.
You would have to agree that the DNA evidence was the most critical and important evidence at the trial for the state.
Your Honor, I actually don't agree. And I think that the analysis for the prejudice purposes has kind of gone through an inappropriate viewing the evidence in isolation from one another. And I think if we do that, then yes, it suddenly becomes the DNA is this major thing. But the fact that there was secretor testimony that gets us down to about 33% of the population, the fact that Taylor was dropped off at the house shortly before the victim was killed, seemingly, the fact that Taylor was the jewelry, the victim's, you know, unique jewelry was found in the backyard where Taylor was residing at the time. He resided there from September, when the victim was murdered, till roughly December, and it was found in the backyard in January. So I think when you put all of those things together, I don't think the DNA becomes this overwhelming 800-pound gorilla. It certainly was useful for the state, but I don't think that it was a linchpin conclusive, you know, in conclusive nature on its own.
But the numbers being thrown around, I mean, you know, one and insert the blank million, that's pretty powerful. That's a pretty powerful rhetorical device, right?
I think it is a powerful rhetorical device, not, I think, so much as powerful as the ones that we use now. One in 6 million, to me as a newer attorney, is very low, actually. One in 23 million isn't all that much better.
Definitely different from one in three. Which
yes.
is what your secretor testimony gets you.
Yes, but one in three individuals was not dropped off near the victim's house. One in three individuals was not found digging in their backyard looking for something they couldn't find, the victim's unique jewelry that had been recovered shortly before. One in three people did not confess to Timothy Cowart and then attempt to escape from custody because they were afraid that the state would prevail.
Let me ask you this. I certainly understand that the principal prejudice argument that the state has been pressing is this idea would have been convicted anyway. Look at all the other evidence. What about the Kimmelman piece? Like, we've got to look at whether or not this motion would have been granted. I guess, you know, I expressed to your adversary some skepticism that this judge, who voir dired this expert and allowed him to testify, would have gone the other way on a motion. I mean, is that part of your prejudice argument or no?
So, yes, but if I may reformulate it just a little bit, I don't think Strickland requires this court to look at what this particular judge would have done. It's what objectively reasonable judge under the circumstances would have done. And there is at least a possibility in my mind, and that's why I didn't want to, you know, linger too much on it, that an objectively reasonable judge with all of this in front of him, the correct objections and arguments being made, may have suppressed at least two of the probes that are involved in this case. You'd never get to a situation where Taylor is excluded as a participant, but you'd have something like this is a two-probe analysis, and then everything else is what the state would have. I think there's a possibility of that in light of the cases that came after, Hayes being one, that do seem to indicate that some of these objections had some basis if they were made at the time. But that kind of brings us to another aspect of this Fry and not Fry argument. What would have been established, if we would just take for granted that Florida courts adopted and utilized Fry in 1991, and counsel should have known that, what he would have done would have been a general Fry objection. RFLP DNA testing is not generally accepted in the scientific community at that point in time. That's the objection that he would have had available if all of the law was clear on Fry as it had developed up to that point. There was no district court case to the contrary. He would have made a straightforward RFLP testing argument. That is not the argument that Taylor argues he should have made. Taylor argues he should have gone into the expert's methodology and said, well, the population statistics should have been attacked, the specific nuances of how the tests were performed should have been attacked. But that is not part of Fry inherently. I cited in my brief cases from the Washington Supreme Court and California Supreme Court, which also utilize Fry, to show that the idea that you would use Fry to attack a methodology was not a foregone conclusion. And Washington, when they did their DNA, they used RFLP DNA testing. That's what you attack under Fry. Anything regarding the methodology, anything else, would go to weight, not admissibility. The California Supreme Court reached a very similar result. They said you can only do RFLP DNA testing as your Fry objection, but we think under state law it's important to have a higher standard, so we're going to modify Fry to the point where you can make a methodology objection. But the methodology objection certainly doesn't come into the Florida Supreme Court's cases, seemingly until Hayes, where they dealt with it as an issue of first impression, whether the methodology could be attacked. So I think even kind of granting all the concessions that we could, the law being clear at the time, counsel should have researched and done a Fry objection, the Fry objection he would have raised is still not the one that Taylor urges he should have raised. It would have been a general RFLP DNA testing was not generally accepted in the scientific community. And that objection likely would not have been sustained. No court in Florida ever wholly excluded RFLP DNA testing on that basis, being itself. So I don't think we're in a situation where counsel is ineffective. And I take Judge Wilson's comment earlier about what don't know what counsel did. Counsel testified. It's very clear he couldn't recall what he had done. He very well may have done an in-depth legal analysis and research. The problem is, when he went to trial, it was 1991, when he was testifying in post-conviction, I believe it was 2007. There was a long time there for counsel to forget what exact steps he took in this old case. And that's why I think this court's precedent, quite correctly, doesn't give defense counsel the benefit of a counsel's short memory. That when the record is unclear about what counsel did, we assume that presumption of effective assistance kicks in, and we assume that he took all of the steps that he should have taken. And the mere fact that he didn't file a Fry motion in this case doesn't bring us to the contrary conclusion. Because as we've discussed, the Fry objection that he would have raised at the time would have been very different, and he had his own expert telling him there are no issues with the state's DNA testing at this point.
Did he have notes at the evidentiary hearing?
Not clear to me, Your Honor, whether he had notes. I know his trial file had been destroyed in a fire, and that's been undisputed up to this point. So I don't recall him having notes or testifying off notes, but I certainly couldn't speak to that definitively either way.
Can you just remind me, we know sort of the characterizations of the testimony, either like, I didn't know anything about Fry, or I just simply have no present recollection of my understanding of Fry at the time. Did the circuit court make any findings about his understanding or lack thereof with respect to Fry?
No, Your Honor. The circuit court dealt with it really the same way as the Florida Supreme Court These were evolutions in Florida law, and so he can't be deficient for failing to predict the future. So there were no specific findings on those issues, certainly.
What was the if you take the DNA evidence out of the picture, what was the evidence on the sexual assault?
So you still have the serologist testimony, 33%. I do think that we learned from the Murray opinion, Murray actually was type B and the victim was type O. So even if this had been delved into more specifically, Taylor still is the one. You also at the same time have his confession to Timothy Cowart, which was maybe not actually directly on the sexual assault, but certainly on the choking her, stabbing her, doing all those things in the lead up. So I think we're probably left with the secretor for the sexual assault. And then just the fact that she was raped, and we know it wasn't Murray because type B versus type, or at least he's not the one who deposited his semen inside her, because he's type B and Taylor is type A, which is the secretor type found inside. And in one of the Murray cases from 1997, the Florida Supreme Court noted that Murray was eliminated as a donor of all the seminal and blood stains found at the crime scene and matched to a single hair. And my understanding of Florida's hair analysis is we probably couldn't have done that early in 1991, and that's why Murray likely lingered a lot longer than Taylor did. So regarding kind of going more into the prejudice analysis, I do think we're very more in Kimmelman territory, where there are two prongs that have to be shown. First, the motion would have been meritorious, which we've kind of discussed that maybe there's a possibility that counsel could have gotten some of this excluded. But the second is that with that exclusion, you'd have a reasonable probability of a different outcome. That's what the analysis the Supreme Court did in Kimmelman. And I think when we look at the entirety of the evidence in this case, the DNA evidence was certainly helpful to the state, but there is no reasonable probability that Taylor would have been either acquitted or received a life sentence without it, based on what's been raised here. I did want to speak, and it kind of, I'm not quite sure whether it went to the Fry or the Brady, very quickly, about the adverse credibility determination on Dr. Libby.
Now, the ultimate issue, though, for our purposes, is not whether or not he was guilty or innocent, but the application of an aggravator, though, right? At least that's what the blue brief says.
So, Your Honor, it'd be either a life sentence, so if you were to take away this aggravator, if it would have truly gone away, would that have been enough then to give a reasonable probability of a life sentence?
Okay, I got you.
But you'd have to do one or the other. Either reasonable probability of an acquittal or reasonable probability of a life sentence is also certainly on the table. But I don't think that you end up getting there based on, even if you were to strike an ag, I don't think that you'd get a reasonable probability of a different outcome from the judge in this case. There was some discussion about Murray's death sentences being vacated several times, and that's true. Murray is still kicking around in the Florida state system. But I'm not aware of any of those cases really being comparable to this one, where it was vacated on an ineffective assistance of counsel for failure to raise a Fry motion or anything of that nature. By the time Murray's case came out from the Florida Supreme Court in 1997, we had Hayes, we had a lot more clarification on what counsel could do and how he could challenge this evidence. So I think that really ends up with this Fry type analysis. We had a significant other amount of evidence. There's no reasonable probability of a different outcome, either acquittal or life sentence in this case. And because our prejudice is de novo. The prejudice argument I've made to you was not passed on by the Florida Supreme Court. That would be reviewed by the case de novo, by this court de novo. But certainly, I don't think that there was a violation of clearly established law to hold that counsel was not deficient for failing, or to hold the counsel was not deficient for failing to predict what the Florida Supreme Court determined as a matter of state law were changes and evolutions in state law. Your Honors, if you have no further questions, I'll yield the balance of my time.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Rodriguez.
Thank you.
Mr. Gunn, you have reserved some time for rebuttal.
Thank you. I'd just like to make a few few follow-up points. Number one, on this issue of Ziegler testifying about the computer pronouns versus the match and the probes, I just wanted to point the court to page 1274 of the post-conviction record, where she does make clear that she's referring to the computer pronouns, not the analysis of the probes. The second point I want to make, and this was brought up in Judge Newsom's questioning, we don't need precedent applying Frye to DNA cases. And as Your Honor mentioned, it would make little sense to have a rule where the Frye had been applied to a novel technique before counsel was expected to file a motion, because Frye is about novel scientific evidence. So it's been applied from everything from hypnosis to bite marks to cut wounds. And so it wouldn't make any sense to say, well, you need Frye being applied to bite marks or to knife wounds. So what we're looking at here is when Frye was established.
Can I ask you a quick question on this? Sure. Because I think I sort of took the state to be making three maybe slightly different arguments in the same vein. One is Frye had never been applied to DNA. I got to tell you, I'm not wowed by that. Another is it was like unclear at the time whether like Frye or Daubert was the governing standard. And the third is the extent that, you know, sort of Frye was a live issue, it applied to certain types of challenges, methodological challenges, but not others. Can you address the latter two of those?
Sure. So Frye was very clearly established in Florida, at least in 1989, and that's the Stokes case. There's numerous Florida Supreme Court decisions since then, and I'll just mention Haddon and Ramirez. They definitively say Frye was established at least in Stokes in 1989 and probably going back to the mid-1980s in the Bundy cases. So I think it was really clear that, you know, even if we take the point about Andrews, the 1988 DCA case, and they were confused about whether Frye, that was put to rest a year later, 2 years before Mr. Taylor's trial. So Stokes, 1989, Frye was firmly established in Florida. On the third point about Frye and how it wasn't applied to specific procedures.
So before you leave that, sure. Stokes and Ramirez are the main cases. If we were to cite a case, that would establish that lawyers were making Frye motions to challenge DNA evidence in 1991, we would point to Stokes, we would point to Ramirez, and what else would we point to?
Not to Frye's applied to DNA, Your Honor, but Frye was the standard for novel techniques in Florida. Stokes, I would cite as the main case. Ramirez was a later case, that was a case, and Haddon also after Mr. Taylor's trial, but they discussed the Frye test, and they say definitively it was established in Stokes, and they also cite the two Ted Bundy cases from the mid-1980s. So I think that was really clear that Frye was established as the proper mechanism, and Mr. Tassoni just didn't know about it. As to the issue of whether Frye, we had to have cases saying that Frye applies to all the methodological steps of DNA analysis, I don't think that makes a lot of sense either. If you even go back to Frye itself, which was about lie detector technology, one of the things the defense wanted to do in that case was demonstrate for the jury the procedure by which the lie detector worked. And so they wanted to walk the jury through the methodological methods, and that's what ended up getting reversed by the DC Circuit. So I think Frye inherently encompasses these methodological challenges. It just wouldn't work any other way to say it only applies to a new science, and then you have to wait until some cases say, well, these procedures also apply. So I would contend that Frye itself inherently recognizes that procedures are part of the analysis. The other quick point I wanted to make is the Florida Supreme Court has also been clear that when we're looking at the time of general acceptance for Frye, it's the time of the appeal. Maybe somewhat counterintuitive, but the case Hayes from the Florida Supreme Court and Haddon both look at the time of appeal. And so particularly given that, I think we have to look at what if Mr. Taylor's trial counsel had objected under Frye, what would have happened on appeal? And if you look at Murray, if you look at Hayes, which was a 1990 homicide that had gone up on direct appeal after Mr. Taylor's, the Florida Supreme Court was enforcing this idea that we don't want unreliable, novel scientific techniques. And so I think even if the trial court had not granted the motion, there's a reasonable probability that the Florida Supreme Court would reverse it on appeal. The jury's verdict is not worthy of confidence in this case, and the district court should be reversed. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Court is in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.